Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome everybody, welcome. Storytelling can take many forms, and today we're joined by two amazing women who dedicate their time in different ways to wake us up before it's too late. Coming up around 12:30, we'll talk with conservationist and author Dr. Laurie Marker. She's been hailed as a visionary in species conservation, including holistic conservation actions for habitat, other species, and local communities and livelihoods. And she's written a great new book called A Future for Cheetahs. We're also talking with the other amazing half of this book, the photographer, wildlife photographer, Susie Esterhaas. And we're going to be talking about A Future for Cheetahs with both of them coming up. She is, as I said, a professional wildlife photographer. She's based in California. She specializes in documenting the family lives of endangered species and is well known for unprecedented work with newborn animals. What a lovely job working with newborn animals. Her images are published in books, magazines, and newspapers all over the world, including the front cover of Time magazine, Smithsonian, BBC Wildlife, National Geo, Scientific America, Audubon. The list goes on. Susie Esterhaas, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Am I saying your last name right, Susie?
You are, yes.
Okay, we didn't have time to check before we went live this morning. So let's talk a little bit about the book, and then we'll talk some more about the other work that you do. You worked on this book with Dr. Laurie Marker. I read somewhere that somebody asked you, how did you create a project like this for yourself? And you said, how did you find this project? And you said you really created it for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us about that.
Well, it's true. So I basically, when I was much younger, I had the opportunity to work in the Serengeti and absolutely fell in love with cheetahs. And when I came back to the United States, I decided that I wanted to do a project that followed cheetah cubs from sort of infancy to adulthood. And I really sort of had the idea of doing this as a magazine story. And I looked up Laurie Marker, obviously, because she is still the world's leading expert on cheetahs. And I made connections with her, and we decided that we would work together on the project. And it went from being a magazine story to a book project as we just sort of found that it was getting more in-depth than we had planned. And we both really connected as people and as creative partners. So we decided to do this book together. So I essentially just, I had this start where I was at the time having to do a day job, and I had saved a bunch of money for this project. And I decided when I got an email from a contact in the Serengeti, I had sort of a scout on the ground working, got an email, you know, we have some cheetah cubs out, and I just decided to change my life completely. And quit the day job, drained my savings account, put all my stuff in storage, got rid of the apartment, and just basically flew over to Africa to start this project. And I kind of thought I would do, you know, small pieces, like a couple weeks here and there. But what I wound up doing is from that day forward, I wound up staying for the vast majority of almost 3 years in a little bush camp in the Maasai Mara in Kenya.
Well, that's just amazing. This book is amazing. The photograph's amazing, and the story is amazing in the book. So what was it that got you interested in photography? You said you had a day job. What was your day job, and what got you interested in photography?
Well, photography has always been my goal ever since I was a kid. So I was just one of those weird kids that knew exactly what I wanted to do with my life. You know, and I was walking around as like a six-year-old saying I was going to live in a tent in Africa. So yeah, it just definitely was the goal. And, you know, wildlife photography is not something that you can just sort of, when you graduate from college, say, I'm going to go get a job as a wildlife photographer. You need to sort of have a day job and you know, break into the field very slowly. So, so anyway, it was definitely something that was planned all along. And my day job was I worked as a PR director at an SPCA, so it was very animal focused, but certainly not cheetahs and not photography.
Mm. And so then why cheetahs? And are the cubs in here? I mean, I just want to pick them up and cuddle them, and I know that's not what you're supposed to do, but they're just so beautiful and beautifully photographed. You can see every little hair on their face. So why cheetahs? Why cheetahs?
You know, I don't know. Cheetahs always just captivated me more than the other animals in the Serengeti, you know, and there's some really, for a wildlife photographer, there's, you know, your really sort of typical sexy megafauna that you think of for African wildlife. You've got elephants, you've got lions, you've leopard, cheetah, mm-hmm. rhinos. But there was something about the cheetah that just absolutely captivated me. More so than the other animals. And I think that part of it was their vulnerability. You know, these are creatures that don't have a lot of defense. Their mechanism for when they're approached by a predator is to run. They rely on their speed. So these are animals that are very vulnerable to predation and also very vulnerable due to things that man is bringing into the picture, like habitat loss and prey loss. So that could have been part of it. And then, you know, this sounds pretty stupid, but cheetah cubs are also absolutely adorable.
They are. So
they're very photogenic and they're really fun to watch.
What I love, and I didn't know this about cheetah cubs until I saw your book, but when they're tiny, they almost have like a lion's mane that runs down their back, and then they lose that as they grow up.
Mm-hmm.
They've got all that fluffy hair standing up on end, and that makes them look so cute.
It makes them look really cute, and the sort of, you know, the jury's out in terms of what that actually is for, but most people say that it's so that they look a little bit like a honey badger to predators that may try to approach the cub. So that's, you know, one thing, and then, you know, other people say, well, it's, you know, just for sort of camouflage in the nest, it does make them really cute, and they are very furry and fluffy. They're sort of like, you know, little fur balls and cotton balls, way more so than lion cubs. So, you know, as from a photography perspective, they are absolutely adorable. And, of course, cheetahs are so beautiful with their teardrop on their face and, you know, the teardrop eyes, but also just their really elegant, sleek bodies. And the cubs have that even as babies.
Mm-hmm. So you... cheetah, I think is the fastest animal on Earth. Is that right?
They're the fastest land mammal. Yeah.
Yeah, and I've read that they run up to speeds of 70 miles an hour. So, what kind of special needs? I mean, as a photographer, I'm looking at the photographs here, and you have a cheetah clearly in chase of an animal here, and there's not one instance of blur factor here. So, what special things do you have to do to make sure you capture that in detail?
Couple techniques you can take with an animal that's moving that fast, capturing the action, especially when they're sprinting after a gazelle, you sort of want to freeze it. So you have to use, you know, shutter speeds that are very high. But then also there's ways, some of the images in there, you'll see where the cheetah's sprinting. And I've intentionally done some sort of blur pan where you use a slower shutter speed. But in terms of practically, it just means that you have to sort of try to predict where the animal's going to run and which way they're going to run the prey. So, like, getting that sequence of the cheetah going after the gazelle, that actually took 11 days. So in that period, I decided, okay, you know, I need to get hunting behavior. So stop focusing on the cubs, stop focusing on other things, and just really target hunting cheetahs. And it was 11 days of, you know, sometimes they didn't make a kill that day. You know, 2 out of 3 hunts are not successful. So there was that. And then there was also, even on a successful hunt, sometimes they would run the prey in a different direction than the direction that I had hoped they would run.
Right.
Or into a direction where I couldn't follow, or maybe it was too rocky to get my Jeep up. So all the factors kind of have to come in together. The light has to be right. I need to be in the right position. The cheetah needs to run the animal in the right direction. You know, I've got to have the right lens on. I had a time where I was watching a cheetah running after a gazelle, and it was at a distance, and she made this incredible long sprint and wound up running the gazelle right past my vehicle, and I needed a wide angle, but I had the 500 mil on. So, you know, there's a lot of sort of trial and tribulation that comes with trying to photograph something as specific as that.
Right.
And then, you know, there's a special, too, you know, always with hunting predators, you have to be very sensitive to not impacting their hunt and screwing it up for them. So you have to sort of stay at a distance away, use long lenses, and be very sensitive to not giving that the predator away to the prey, or scaring off the prey with the presence of your vehicle. And ruining their hunt, because already the odds are stacked against them, right? 2 out of 3,
right,
hunts are not going to be successful, so you don't really want to contribute to that in any way, shape, or form, especially if there's adorable cubs that she's trying to feed.
Right. And how difficult is it, though, to watch those kills?
It's not. For me, the sort of predation stuff is not difficult to shoot. What is difficult to shoot is watching, because usually with the hunts, you know, the animal dies quite quickly, and this is all about food. What was extremely difficult for me was some of the images in the book you will see are a mom with 5 newborn cubs in the nest, and the cubs are, you know, 4 days old, tiny. And over a 19-day period, I watched every single one of them die. And that was extremely difficult for me. That was heartbreaking. And, you know, for I think for any wildlife photographer in that position, it would be a heartbreaking thing to watch. And the way they died was all natural predation. So mm-hmm. It was, you know, martial eagles came in and took the first 3, and the last 2 were taken by jackals in the night. It was a moonlit night when mom was off hunting, which cheetahs don't often hunt at night, but on full moon nights they do. You know, that kind of thing was incredibly difficult, you know, and there are parts of nature that can be very hard.
Yeah. You've also got in here, obviously, poaching is a huge factor in losing so many of our beautiful animals. You've got in here giraffes and an elephant that have been killed for ivory and other purposes.
Right.
So,
it is. I mean, it's a huge prey loss is something that habitat loss and prey loss are, I think, our 2 biggest impacts on cheetahs. And prey loss is absolutely, and even in places that are protected like the Masai Mara, my experience working with an anti-poaching team was in protected areas of the Masai Mara and also Serengeti National Park, areas that are very heavily patrolled. But in those areas, we're still seeing statistics like 120,000 wildebeest poached in 1 year. There's a big commercial meat trade in Africa. So it's not even just, you know, we tend to focus on the species like elephant and rhino. When we talk about poaching, we're talking about, you know, ivory and rhino horn. But if you look at the meat poaching, that's on a scale that's just in some places, just it's hard to fathom the scale that it's going on. And there's no way this isn't impacting predators like cheetahs and lions and leopard when that much of their prey is going to humans.
Right. And I know that the work that you're doing through your photography and Dr. Laurie Marker's doing through her conservation fund is all to raise awareness on this. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk about some of the other work that you do, because this is not all that you do. Beautiful.
Okay, great.
It's beautiful. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest is Susie Esterhaas, wildlife photographer. And the book that we're talking about today that is so beautifully photographed is A Future for Cheetahs. We'll be right back.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Listen to podcasts of past shows at conversationslive.net.
Don't touch that dial. You might miss something life-changing. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everybody. You are listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and we're talking all about cheetahs today and conservation. And we're talking right now with Susie Esterhaz. She's a professional wildlife photographer based in California, but she's spent several years in Africa. And she teamed up, as we talked about in the first half of this segment, with Dr. Laurie Marker, who's a conservation founder for the Cheetah Organization. And we'll be talking with Dr. Laurie Marker in just 15 minutes, 10 minutes or so. But I wanted to talk a little bit, Susie, about some of the other work you do. You have a six-title series called Eye on the Wild. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so basically that work is the work that I do following a different species from infancy to adulthood. And it's a series for children ages 4 to 7. And basically it's just a culmination of work from various different subjects I've worked with all over the world. So there's one about cheetahs, there's one about lion, there's one about brown bears, tiger and elephant are coming out in June. So that's basically just a series to introduce children to the various things that these different animals go through as they grow up. And it's a great, you know, the growing up baby concept has always been quite popular with children. And it, you know, we even weave it into our adult cheetah book, actually, because it's popular with adults as well. But particularly for children, I think that it's something that kids can relate to. And it's something that it's very tangible. So there's certain things like mom nurturing them, mom feeding right. them, mom protecting them from danger, playing, you know, getting older and kind of experiencing life on their own and getting more independent. So these are all things that I think young kids can really latch onto, which is, I think, one of the reasons why baby animals are so popular with children. It's not just that they're cute and cuddly and adorable and they make kids go, aw, but it's also just something that kids can just really, you know, kids, it's hard to find things that children can relate to, especially small children. And baby animals have always historically been something that they can kind of latch onto.
Yeah, and I think it's important to instill the value of these beautiful creatures, whatever they are, and our natural environment into children so they grow up with a respect for it.
Definitely. And you know, the fact that you might influence a 4 or 5-year-old child, you know, in a place in the United States, let's just say, you know, even in California or Washington, you know, these kids, if they ever see a cheetah, it'll probably be in a zoo. So being able to just foster that interest of these animals in the wild and, you know, having respect for those animals and maybe an incentive to care mm-hmm. if they're still around and to care about protecting their habitat and the food that they eat. I think if we can get kids when they're really young, that's a huge target audience for conservation. And unfortunately, it's also, an audience that conservationists sometimes ignore.
Yeah, and I'm going to ask Dr. Laurie Marker the same question, but I'd like to get your perspective too. Mm-hmm. You know, there are people there who say, hey, you know, species wiping out, because I read that over the last 100 years, 90% of the cheetah population, for example, has been decimated. And there are people who will say, hey, that's just evolution. You know, we don't have the big woolly mammoth anymore. And there are other people who say they don't care. And I actually talked to somebody a couple of weeks ago, said, well, you know, it doesn't affect me whether they're here or whether they're not here. So why should I care? What's your response to that?
It's a real tough one. I think to say that it doesn't affect you is something that you don't realize it's affecting you.
Right.
But you know, things like habitat loss, these are the reasons why we have global warming right now. These are the reasons why we have, you know, the extreme weather that we're going through. So even someone who doesn't care, who lives down the block from me in California and will never go to Africa and see these animals and just has no desire, they're still being affected. And the things that are happening with cheetahs in Africa are happening here in our own neighborhoods, in our own backyards. Same thing is happening to pumas that we used to share our habitat with, or, you know, black bears used to roam the coast of California, grizzly bears used to roam our coast.
Mm-hmm.
So these are all things that, you know, okay, it might be far away in Africa when we think about cheetahs, but there are parallels going on all around us on many different levels. It can be everything from amphibians to our large great predators that we so admire.
Yeah. I read that you also worked with gorillas at one point. Tell us a little bit about that project.
Well, the gorilla stuff, I mean, people always at my lectures, they ask, like, what is the the best wildlife experience on the planet. If you're going to do one and only one, what should it be? And I always say mountain gorillas. And I don't say that because I like them better than an animal like cheetahs, but working with them is such an experience. And it seems like every time I have a shoot with gorillas, it is so intimate. I mean, part of that is because they're so habituated to human mm-hmm. presence.
Right.
And through the work of people like Diane Fossey and now tourism coming in, you know, these gorillas just basically, I always say, like, you know, the goal for me as a wildlife photographer when I'm working with these animal families is just disappear and become part of the landscape. If I could just become a boulder in the landscape, I'll be happy, because then the animals will live their lives around me and I can photograph it. And that's what happens with the gorillas without even you having to try,
right.
Which is amazing. They just do their own thing. They live naturally, and you can be within 20 feet of them and they won't care. You can even get closer, but we don't like to because of germ transference and things like that. But the experience of just sitting with them as they live their lives out amongst you is incredible.
Yeah. So you go to a lot of areas over the world that a lot of people wouldn't want to travel to because of the political situations out there.
Mm-hmm.
Have you run into situations where you thought, what the heck am I doing here? Get me out of here quick.
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, if you go to some of these troubled areas, you definitely can have those experiences. Having said that, you can have them a block away from your house.
This is
well.
So true. You can have
yeah,
them next
but,
door.
You know, as women, yeah, they're, and, you know, even as a man traveling, but particularly as a woman traveling on your own, you have to take certain precautions. And, yeah, there's been situations where I've thought, just get me out of here and get me home. And you have to sort of take calculated risks. And I think I calculate more, my risks more than I used to in my younger days. I think I used to just go out and do stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And now I kind of think a little bit more, mostly just because I've had experiences that have been unpleasant, you know, where you do. And that's the thing with wildlife photography. People always say, like, what's the most dangerous animal you've ever worked with? And it's humans.
Yes.
And it always will be, you know, in these areas. Yes, you will have to worry about snakes and certain parasites and diseases, but it's really the people you have to worry about.
You know, my dad always used to tell me that it's you don't need to be afraid of that. You need to be afraid of people.
Yeah.
Or not afraid of them, but worry. So with all of these, what do you hope with the photographs and this book, this beautiful book that's come out? What do you hope people will take away from it?
I hope people will take away the beauty of that animal that we're losing and, you know, appreciate that this is an incredible, gorgeous animal that is worth protecting. And I also hope that they might tell somebody else about the plight of the cheetah. This might raise some awareness. And I hope that they will take home some of those conservation messages that Lori so beautifully tells
yes.
about humans and animals coexisting. And I hope, you know, these are concepts, the ones that she talks about are concepts that you can apply throughout the world. And we can use them for our own animals in our own backyards and neighborhoods and really live in a way that is more peaceful coexistence than we are now.
That sounds great. And I think that's a great note to end this segment on. So let's tell our listeners where they can find out more about you. I have your website as susieesterhaas.com, correct?
Yep, that's right. Yep.
All right. Do you want to spell that out for people since your name is a little different?
Sure. It's Susie, SusieEsterhaas. .com.
All
that's
right.
SusieEsterhaas.com.
And there's a lot of information out there about Susie and the work that she does, and a great job on this, Susie, and all of the stuff that you're doing. We need to hear this stuff. We need to see it. It's important to see it, I think. It makes a difference.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Vicki.
Oh, my pleasure, my pleasure. And please stay with us. When we come back from the break, we'll be talking with Dr. Lori Marker, who told the written story in this book, A Future for Cheetahs. We'll be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Monday, May 12th on Conversations Live, four-time Emmy Award winner Hattie Kaufman. After two decades interviewing presidents, Oscar winners, astronauts, and Olympians, Kaufman is telling her own story for the first time with Falling Into Place. It's shocking, heartbreaking, uplifting, and redemptive. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicki St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicki partners with people just like you at the exact level you need, whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicki today. Email Vicki at VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967, because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
This is Martha Nerwak. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to Dr. Bill Burlingame's Immune Support, we cover the world of animals. This week, May 11th, it's a Behavior Training and Healing Sunday with me. We'll get more details about Maryland's fundraising project for animals. Practicing for hosting the show, Kathy will interview me. Plus, we'll have open phone lines so I can help you solve any behavior training or healing problems with your animal friends. Plan to give me a call on Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Making a difference, one word at a time.
1150kknw.com. It's why they invented the internet. We think. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And as we said at the top of the hour, we are talking about a future for cheetahs today. They're racing against extinction. So we have somebody who's considered the world's leading expert making the case with us today for saving the cheetah. And let me introduce her formally. She is Dr. Laurie Marker. She's the executive director and founder of the Cheetah Conservation Fund, an international nonprofit global organization. She's been hailed as a visionary in species conservation, including holistic conservation actions for habitat, other species, and local communities and livelihoods. And Dr. Marker is a recipient of the Tyler Prize for Environmental Achievement, which is considered the Nobel Prize for environmental issues. She's been awarded the Gold Medal from the Society of Women's Geographers, the Lowell Thomas Award, the Tech Museum's Intel Environmental Prize, and the list goes on. She's been named a hero for the planet by Time Magazine, and she's been featured in Smithsonian and National Geographic Magazine, as well as on many television shows, including The Tonight Show, Good Morning America, and The Today Show. Dr. Laurie Marker, welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you. It's great to talk to you.
And to you. And we're very pleased, to have you here today, talking with the photographer first, and now we're going to talk about the story behind the cheetah. And I'd really like to begin with a little bit more about this magnificent creature. I've always looked at them and thought, you know, if ever an animal was crafted and chiseled to almost perfection, it has to be the cheetah. So It's Africa's oldest and biggest cat, I understand, and also its most endangered.
It's Africa's oldest and most endangered. It's the it's one of the big cats, but with that, it's the fastest land animal. It's absolutely amazing. I agree with you. They're just chiseled to perfection, and I always call it speed and elegance blended together. And every part of their body is basically adapted and evolved into being the most amazing of all the 37 species of cats. I'm partial.
Of course. So I read that you began research on these cats in 1974. So what was it that drove you to this lifestyle? Because it's not just a job, it is a lifestyle. And why the cheetah in particular?
Well, I worked at the wildlife safari in Winston, Oregon, which is in the southern part of Oregon, and where the two cheetahs that are now up at the Woodland Park Zoo have come from. And the park had just opened, and we had cheetahs, sort of the last group of cheetahs that had come from Africa in the early 70s. And nobody in the world had cheetahs in captivity. And I wrote to anybody who I thought might have had them in the past and said, I'm really fascinated about cheetahs. What can you tell me? And they'd write back, and they'd say, well, when you find out something about cheetahs, let us know. They have a short lifespan. They don't breed in captivity, and we're losing them in the wild. Good luck. And that just, I just couldn't believe it. People have revered them for 5,000 years, and I wanted to know everything there was to know about them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what launched me onto a 40-year career in telling you anything you'd like to know about the cheetah, but we're afraid to ask.
So you worked with the Smithsonian, and you worked with the American Cancer Society, too, on that. Talk to us a little bit about that, or the National Cancer Institute.
Well, our early research on cheetahs and trying to understand more about them was in the early 80s. Now, again, I was in Oregon, and we had one of the few places in the world that was breeding cheetahs. And so I had a very a large breeding collection of cheetahs there that I was responsible for. And working together, we tried to find out more about the cheetah, and it launched us into finding out that they actually lack genetic diversity. So our early research in the 1980s went from understanding and trying to see what they're like. We were collecting sperm and looking at how we could bank the sperm down for, again, applied reproduction in the future, and found that they had 70 to 80% abnormal sperm. And genetically, then, we started realizing that they all looked like almost identical twins. In the early genetic work that we were doing, now we've been able to much more hone in on the long-term research we've done on genetics. But that's kind of where it all started.
And so then you left Smithsonian. The Smithsonian in 1990 moved to Namibia to help save the cheetahs. That was a huge move. I mean, you give up this prestigious job, move to this country where it's very different. Tell us about that part of the journey for you.
Well, I just kept saying to other large, say to everybody, look at the wild cheetah. And I've been working in Namibia since the middle 1970s. And in and out of Namibia and other African countries. And I kept saying, we're losing them in the wild. The farmers in the 1980s, the livestock farmers, were killing like 1,000 cheetahs a year. And I kept saying, we need to do something. Somebody's got to go over there and save the wild cheetah. And I really thought that there was a somebody. And as I kept looking around and everybody sort of said, well, that's an interesting concept, I sold everything that I owned, which wasn't very much, and moved to Namibia at the time of independence for Namibia and set up the Cheetah Conservation Fund as the first and leading organization in saving the cheetah. And our mission is to find out ways conserving the cheetah. And we work in community development and a lot of research and ecology in trying to find ways that the cheetah can have a future.
Yeah. So what kind of challenges have you faced in building this conservation fund? Because oftentimes there are men out there forging the way in this. There aren't too many. I mean, we know, you know, Dr. Jane Goodall and, of course, Diane Fossey, but we can pretty much name them on one hand. So what have been some of the biggest challenges for you as a woman?
Well, I think that's very interesting. And as I moved into Namibia, the farmers, ranchers that I was talking to were all men, and I think a lot of it in being a woman and also being an American, which I think is quite interesting. So, I mean, I was viewed from a variety of different angles. But as a scientist, I think I won the hearts and souls as well, mm-hmm. because I was trying to talk about practicalities. I was trying to get to the bottom of things. And understanding it, as I started talking to the ranchers about some of the reproductive problems, the genetic problems that the cheetah had, and started looking at the wildlife management initiatives that could be incorporated into their landscape so that they would not have livestock losses, yeah, they started really embracing me much more. Being a woman, I mean, I started with a old beat-up Land Rover and today have a 100,000-acre huge integrated ranch with the model farm with livestock, goats, sheep, cattle, wildlife everywhere, cheetahs, leopards, hyenas. It's integrated, and we're a training center. We train people from throughout Namibia and around the world in these kinds of systems that I think are going to be the models to actually change the world where we are today. But I started with an old Land Rover, and I drove door-to-door talking with farmers. And so I just think of my car breaking down, and, you know, we're on dirt roads, and how much use I get out of my car at this point mm-hmm. and other cars. But now I've gone, you know, we're a $2 million operation with, I've got over 90 people working for me and the cheetah. And kids are going to university, and they're being graduated and becoming the scientists of Africa. And that is a pretty amazing story over a 25-year period. And they keep saying, you know, now, I mean, it's just they call me the cheetah lady, and everybody looks at me and knows me.
I think right. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I'm going to ask you about a couple of the programs that you've put into place there to help not just the cheetahs, but also the community and the landowners there. So my guest is Dr. Laurie Marker from the Cheetah Conservation Fund. Her book is called A Future for Cheetahs. And, of course, we talked with the photographer for that book earlier, Susie Esterhaz. We'll be right back with you. Please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live.
This is Meryl Streep. Over the years, I have played some characters you could call controlling, but the truth is, there's so much in life we can't control. But here's something we can, colorectal cancer. It affects men and women, and it's the second leading cancer killer in the U.S., which is astounding, considering it's almost entirely preventable. Here's how. Most colon cancers start as polyps, and screening helps find polyps so they can be removed before they even turn into cancer. Screening also finds this cancer early, when treatment works best. For me, screening was simple and quick. It was no big deal, except for the huge sense of relief you feel afterwards. There are several tests that you can choose from. If you're 50 or older, you should talk to your doctor. Decide which one's right for you. Take control. Do everything you can to prevent colon cancer. Screening saves lives. It could really save your life. For more information, call 1-800-CDC-INFO.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Monday, May 12th on Conversations Live, four-time Emmy Award winner Hattie Kaufman. After two decades interviewing presidents, Oscar winners, astronauts, and Olympians, Kaufman is telling her own story for the first time with Falling Into Place. It's shocking, heartbreaking, uplifting, and redemptive. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
OMG! Grammar abuses, no, LOL. Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
No shirt, no shoes, no problem. Come as you are. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And my guest in this segment is Dr. Laurie Marker of the Cheetah Conservation Fund. She's the executive director and founder of that conservation fund. She's also known as a visionary and leader in protecting the cheetah and its habitat. And not just that, but I think, Laurie, it's fair to say that you're known as a visionary because you also incorporate the community and get them actively involved, or at least to buy into why this is important. So one of the programs I wanted to talk about is the God Dog program that you instituted.
Great. Well, we use Anatolian Shepherds and Kangal Dogs, which are an ancient breed of a Turkish breed that have been used for around 5,000 years to protect livestock from wolves and bears. And it comes from the old world, and some of these dogs are used here in the United States. We use them extensively now in Namibia and are spreading this throughout other African countries, as well as other countries in the world, bringing back this old remedy, I think, to help farmers, livestock farmers, protect their livestock from predators. So it's a wonderful breed of dog, and we breed them and donate them to the farming community. And we've put out almost 500 dogs in the last 15 years. So it's a very exciting project. And communities, we've got like a two-year waiting list for the dogs.
Yeah. But I mean, I'm imagining that's a huge save for, you know, the farmers, because and then the farmers' livestock is saved, and then they're not going to go out and, you know, shoot the cheetah. And you use dogs because, of course, their sense of smell is so great.
Well, we use dogs with the, you know, they're very alert. So the Anatolians and Kangals we use are very alert. They bark loudly. They know everything that's going on, even though they might be looking like they're asleep under a tree. But they're very active, and it's all about just avoidance. The predators don't want to get hurt. And if the livestock is being protected and the dogs are big and guardians, the livestock then is safe, and the predators will leave that area alone. And that allows us then to talk a lot more about other aspects of livestock management, things like herding and having breeding seasons and the health care of the animals. So we have something that we call Future Farmers of Africa, where we actually train farmers in like week-long programs where they come in to our center and are actually put through a variety of veterinary aspects and health aspects and grazing aspects. And we've put over 3,000 rural farmers through training like that. So that's the kind of approach that we're trying to send throughout many areas of Africa where cheetahs are found. And the use of the dog is extremely important.
Right.
We just put dogs up in Tanzania, and people in Kenya are really interested. We've got dogs working throughout South Africa and other countries like, you know, Brazil and Argentina, where there's, you know, mountain lions and jaguars. The dogs are looking at being put into work there, too. They're extremely intelligent dogs.
Right, right. So you're taking a very holistic approach to this, which I think has, you know, got to work. You're pouring a lot of effort into this. I read on National Geographic that as far as Asiatic cheetahs go, there are less than 100, and they've just had a major conservation program going in Iran, where I didn't even realize there were cheetahs, to be honest, until I read that. But they've managed to up the numbers just a tad, but there's still less than 100 in the wild. You say in the book, it's just one of the most difficult questions to answer about how many there are in the overall population.
Absolutely. And so a lot of the work that we do, things like radio telemetry and the use of camera trapping, has been very useful for us to find out more about how cheetahs live. And yet not often when there's so few animals, like less than 100, that you can actually, you know, get your hands on them and you know, put a collar on. But radio, but looking at like a camera trap works very successfully. But we also use another technique to find out about density of the animals. And we use detection dogs, where we've got dogs that are trained to go and cover an area, basically, and with their great sense of smell. And we've got a great border collie that is wonderful and a Springer Spaniel. And the two of them are out finding scat, or for a biologist, we call that scat black gold, because we can do so much with it. But then that scat can come into our DNA, our genetics lab. We can extract the DNA, and we can find out more about who those individuals are. And so if you see a lot of scat, sometimes people think, oh, you know, in Namibia, oh, there's lots of cheetahs. And yet they're really maybe are the same animal. And or where those different individuals are, so we can then start monitoring more about, you know, with a low population throughout, we have to look at issues around inbreeding and aspects like that as well.
Right, and you also say in the book that they're very susceptible to infectious disease, and we talked a little bit about their genetic sameness, I guess, if you want to break it down to its simplest terms. Is that why they're so susceptible?
Yes, very much so. And we've studied the cheetah probably more so than I would say most any other large carnivore, to the extent that we have biomedically, genetically, ecologically. We know an awful lot about the cheetah. But with that, it does leave them very susceptible to a lot of the different diseases, things like feline infectious peritonitis, other viruses, herpes, calices, and then other problems around like gastritis. So the cheetah is very susceptible because it's all very, very much the same. What saves it probably in the wild is that they live in a low density over a larger space. And therefore, if we start crowding them in together, or they're getting pushed in together, or the human population, which is growing exponentially throughout Africa with their domestic animals that are not vaccinated and cared for, this not only becomes a problem to the cheetah, but even more so to it because of its genetic makeup, it becomes a problem also for, you know, even domestic livestock. So this interface of, you know, Africa and the loss of habitat is quite a problem. And these are things that I call, and I'm trying to get people to get a vision on, of what I say are cheetahscapes.
Right, right. Now, you were up here last week in Seattle at a fundraiser for cheetahs, Saving the Cheetahs, affiliated with Woodland Zoo. So tell us a little bit, you know, a lot of people have conflicting views about zoos, but I do realize that, you know, many times we'd totally lose these animals if zoos didn't take them in and preserve them. So talk to us a little bit about your perspective on that, if you would.
Well, I think zoos are extremely important educational partners. And when I was there at the day of the members' day and the opening, I cannot even believe the numbers of humans that I saw who came to look at the cheetahs and young children. And these young children are going to grow up to be the future. And zoos like the Woodland Park is probably one of the better ones in the whole country. It is. And the way that their philosophy is to really tie in their exhibit animal, and those animals have already bred. They're older female cheetahs. They're on exhibit there for people to actually see. The cats can live out the rest of their life in a lovely, peaceful exhibit, and at the same time tell the story about the need to help us in Africa save the cheetah. So zoos are the conduit. They try to educate, and then they try to get people engaged in helping us. And, you know, we welcome people in Namibia. We want people to come and learn about what we're doing. Come as volunteers. We have a relationship, for instance, at the Cheetah Conservation Fund with the University of Washington and Oregon, and it's kind of a global graduate program where interns can come over. So I have a lot of interns that are with me from Washington State, and then they go off to be, you know, the United States conservationists or other international conservationists. So it's that conduit, I think, that the zoo has a lot of members, and everybody in Seattle is passionate about wildlife. And to be recognized there that cheetahs need help, and to have the people of Seattle know that and try to become involved with us on the ground in Africa, that's the important link between the zoo to helping us in Africa.
Right. Right, right. And I have to say that I don't believe there are cheetahs there, but Point Defiance Zoo down in Tacoma is excellent as well. We do have really good educational zoos here in Washington. What do you think would surprise most people about cheetahs? What is it we don't know that would surprise us?
I think that the thing that is most important around this is the fact that I think we think about wild animals and, you know, wild animals should be in a protected game reserve. And Africa, it's a wonderful place. We'll go visit. And these animals are, you know, in a game reserve, and they're all safe. Well, throughout all of Africa, there are only about 10 game reserves large enough for the cheetah, because the cheetah needs such large areas.
Mm-hmm.
And the protected areas grow up lions and hyenas, and their numbers are higher in numbers. And is there higher densities are there? And the cheetahs are the best hunter. The cheetah actually gets killed quite a bit or pushed off of their prey because the other large predators steal their food and often kill their young. So a female cheetah in a reserve is lucky to actually get a litter of cubs up to maturity. It's like, you know, 90% of the cats, the cubs in the reserves don't make it. So I was thinking outside of the box. Most 90% of the cheetahs are found outside of protected areas on landscapes with humans and their livestock. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's what most people don't know, is that we have to think about the people and the people's livelihoods. And we work in what are called conservancies in Namibia, where we are integrated in the fact that we have livestock, but we have wildlife on our land. So 80% of our wildlife is not found in protected areas. And as we can protect our livestock, wildlife can be growing in the whole picture, and they can overlap and graze in the same places, and predators can be part of an ecosystem. And a top predator like the cheetah is extremely important to maintain the biodiversity of our ecosystems, and they feed the ecosystems. And so top predators are some of our best friends, and we need to learn more about that so that we can keep our healthy systems alive.
Yes, yes. I talked a little bit about Susie as from a photographer's perspective, but in the book you say that Kenya's wildlife has been reduced by 50% in the past 25 years. Illegal trade, of course, is one of the greatest threats that wildlife species faces. So what do you want us to know about that, and what can we do?
Well, as the human population grows, and the African population is growing exponentially as well, in the sub-Saharan African region of Africa, 50% of that population is under 25 years of age. And many of the young women don't get to get educated. And with that, without education, we see an average of, you know, 7 to 10 children. Out of that, that's going to be even more of a problem for poverty. And what I keep seeing is that we're putting Band-Aids on things instead of figuring out that we need alternative livelihoods. And every talk I give, I ask, how many of you want to be a poor, starving farmer in Africa? And I'm always amazed that nobody really wants to be.
Right.
And my friends don't want to be either, my African friends. And so it's really looking outside of that to figure out how we can find ways of making alternative livelihoods. And one of the, you know, interesting things that we're doing is we're trying to restore habitat and put people to work to restore their habitat so that their habitat can be healthier, where we can have more grasses. And if we have more grasses, we could have more wildlife. People come to Africa to see wildlife, and yet we've overgrazed it by so many cattle. And then looking at what those livelihoods look like, tourism is one piece, but we get thick thorn bush that comes in. And as we harvest that thorn bush, we're now looking at trying to even make biomass electricity that could put electricity into rural communities. And if rural communities had electricity, I mean, there's viruses and illnesses that are going on with humans. And oftentimes they can't even treat themselves because they don't even have a refrigerator to put their medicine because there's no electricity. And then if there's electricity, you could have maybe computers. And if you had computers, you could probably learn more. And then maybe you don't have to be a poor, starving farmer.
Right. It's all wheels within wheels here. A Future for Cheetahs is the book. We're right at the end of our segment. So very quick final thought on what you'd say to people who, you know, say, why should I care?
Well, I think it's close to home. Everything is connected. And the big issues really revolve around kind of our climate issues these days. Why should we care? Because it's the fastest land animal. And if we lose the cheetah, well, everybody loves to see a fast animal. The next fastest animal is the pronghorn. It just doesn't have quite the ring. Fast like a pronghorn. But please come to our website and actually learn more, which is cheetah.org, because you can find out why we're all connected, I think, more.
Yes, I think you cover that very well in the book, and your website too does, cheetah.org. Cheetah.org is the website. My guest, Dr. Laurie Marker, thank you so much for being with us today, and what great work you're doing. 40 years you've been doing this. Awesome.
Yes, and the cheetahs are the most wonderful animal there is on the face of the earth.
I tend to agree with you. I think it would be an absolute travesty if they dwindled down to extinction. So, good work. Thanks for being with us.
And try to get our book, everybody who's listening. It's a beautiful book, and everyone will love it.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank each of you for being with us today. The book of Gain is A Future for Cheetahs, photographed by my first guest, Susie Esterhaz, and written by Dr. Laurie Marker. Beautiful storytelling in here. You really get an in-depth look at why we need to preserve these beautiful creatures. And you can find me at info@conversationslive.net. If you have questions or comments on today's show, if you missed any of it, or you can call 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617. We will see you next week. Thanks for being with us. Until then, live well, live strong.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.